Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Final Cut Grill. This is 051. This is, once again, Final Cut Grill and Digital Cinema Cafe will be in sync with each other on episode 51 for just a couple of days. It's 9 o'clock at night when I'm recording this, this intro. This afternoon is a great episode. It's long. I'm not going to ramble on too much. It's with a friend of mine named Jesse Spencer.
Let's take a quick 2 minute break if we can, and I'm going to feed the cat.
Jesse is he's a veteran. He's an old timey guy. He's cut a lot of stuff for many, many years, and he does a lot of, indie stuff and documentaries, and he's one of those guys that has the patience to do the long things that I can't do. And he's also known a little bit as sort of a fixer. You know, when people are stumped and they're in that final stage of their production, a lot of times they end up calling Jesse in to help them out. I know Jesse from SF Cutters. And I also know that he is not a regular Final Cut 10 user, but he's used it a little. He's played with it. He's got great insight. And he's one of those people, kind of like my friend Steve Miller we talked to a while back, looking at it from the outside. It gives you a different perspective. And you will also find that Jesse is a real student of, you know, what it means to be an editor. And I think you'll appreciate this conversation. I apologize I went so long. As I went through it, I was like, I can't cut any of this out. Toward the end, it's like, oh, I'm going to cut this. I liked it. So anyway, you're not going to get a lot of long episodes like this from me because, frankly, it takes a lot longer to prep it and put it together. But this is, I think you're going to enjoy Jesse. Now, you're going to hear more about Premium Beat later on in the piece. So I'm not going to go on too long there. But if you haven't looked at premiumbeat.com, please absolutely go check that out. So here we go. Let's go to the interview with Jesse Spencer from San Francisco.
Can you hear me?
I can. Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Good, good.
When you get up on it like that, how you been?
I've been all right. Busy.
That's awesome.
Yeah, know? Actually, it's been today was sort of the hurry up and wait day. It was a corporate job starting, so there was a lot of slack time.
The super duper top secret one.
Yeah, I guess it's got an NDA. I have no idea what level they would give a crap about me talking about it. So I guess
I don't want to talk about it at all. I know. Yeah,
I wish it was actually interesting, but you know,
there's a point in this business that it's just not. Sometimes a lot of it is, you know, putting together parts and making it all work and getting it all approved. You know, it's not all glamorous at all.
It's certainly much, much less of it is glamorous,
yeah,
than I think anybody was led to believe when they got into it.
That's true. Well, let's talk about that. I'm curious. I mean, obviously, you know, we know each other from SF Cutters, but I don't know much about your history. How did you get into this business?
Into the business? I always enjoyed the idea of making movies, you know, from being a teenager. And that went into, in college, going to the Video Access Center and community access cable kind of stuff. Not that much of it. But then I started doing production in my early 20s. And I found it, it was fascinating, just that commando lifestyle, but I also found it exhausting, and I started realizing that I might want to find the kind of job where a chair was provided for you. So I got into post, and I think I had the aptitude for it, so it stuck.
The commando lifestyle, I like that, yeah.
Well, it's kind of exciting to go to all these exciting places and set up and just have that sort of variability of experience, but you still get the job done, and you can still just pull it off in record time, and there's a lot of job pride in it. But it's exhausting, and I found that, like, the people that you met, you saw them for a little bit and then you never saw them again.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly, if you do it long enough, you cross paths with people again. But I think that's something that most people don't realize, but a really good skill to have if you're in production is remembering names.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
because it seems like quite often it's like, you know, in, out, done, and, you know, maybe we'll cross paths again, but it's hard. It is a commando lifestyle.
I have so much respect for people in production that I made it a part of my job that I daily curse them.
You know, I had an experience, and I've only done this a few times. I had an experience just last week where a client, like at the very last minute, they said, oh, can we send, you know, a 5D package to the studio shoot? And can you have the studio camera guy just, you know, shoot some B-roll, some behind-the-scenes stuff just in his spare time? You know, and like those things never work out well, right? It's like the in your spare time thing. And I started going through the footage, and I was so pleasantly surprised by it. And I actually called the guy. I found who I knew who it was, but it's not somebody that I normally talk with. So I had to get his number from the production manager. I said, I just want to talk to the guy. He goes, what, is there a problem? I go, no, it's the exact opposite. Yeah,
Nobody's excited about a call from post coming forward into production. That usually means that somebody's angry.
Right? I think that in my career, I've probably done it 3, 4, 5 times, something like that, you know?
It would be great if it got more regular, because I would rather partner with these people. But, you know, it's not usually very practical, but it's sort of wonderful that it's evolving that way. I think it, you know, it could be really good.
And I don't want to come across like post snobs and say that all camera crews are, you know, rhesus monkeys with a camera on their shoulder. But clearly some of them are. No.
Well, it's true. And like I said, I daily curse them. But at the same time, it's like, that's the job, dude. You know, fix it. That's your job. Fix it. You know, that's the point. There is sometimes when you see the same mistakes coming up again and again and again, it can be very frustrating because largely because there isn't a pipeline to take your information to them. It's as if that you're...
Wait, are you saying there's no pipeline to get information from post to production?
Yeah, usually isn't a post-mortem opportunity for people to say, well, what can we do better next time? Unless you happen to be an integrated sort of studio and it's all lined up. It's usually, you know, it's come and gone so fast that you just live in a world that you know could be better, but
it's not going to be better today, and we still have to finish this. Yeah.
Some days you just sigh and shrug and, you know.
So when did you get started? What equipment did you first start editing with?
Well, that would be like the RM450 and 2 U-Matic decks. Yep. So, you know, and then later outside of community access video. And I did some 16 millimeter assisting. So, you know, sorting through trim and splicing and taping. I was near a flatbed, but I never really used it that much. And it was sort of on the way out, but I got a good sort of slave labor taste of, you know, just exactly how exhausting and difficult the traditional old film world was.
Right.
So I hope that gave me a lot of perspective, but since I was really kind of getting active in 1990, it really was only going to be so long before the Avid, you know, sort of dominated the market. And then it was all about nonlinear editing. Before I did editing, though, I did quite a lot of, you know, tape op work. So there was a certain amount of standards and formats and video best practices.
Right.
That I started learning too. And so in that way, I got a good little taste of, I'm just not appreciating the hard work that people did with 16 millimeter film, but good God, I can't imagine having to run a 1-inch tape machine all day long. Video was so hard to get right back then.
It really was.
Just amazingly difficult.
Yeah. And I don't think people, I don't know if you saw this. I don't even know. Are you on Twitter? Do you do the
Vaguely.
Twitter?
Vaguely. Yeah, I mean, I've heard of it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So Claudia posted something. Claudia Krask from SF Cutters posted something just the other day, and she said something like, "Does telling old stories about working with 3/4 inch date you, or does it make people respect you for your history or something in the business? And I was like, is that directed at me?
You know, I went to a facility today and they didn't have any HD decks because it wasn't worth investing in HD decks before it all started becoming file based, but they still had a 3/4 inch deck, and I bet you it played just fine. They're like Volkswagens or even like $44 from the government Jeeps. They just don't die. And it's not a very good video signal. I wouldn't trust anything to it, but just the fact that they stuck around and don't expire every 3 years like a laptop, or every 6 months like software, is I think a little bit that there's a lot of people bang their head with how difficult video tech can be, and it's sort of comforting if you know, yes, but that's part of the tradition as well, that it's always been difficult, and it's always getting better, but there's always going to be this area, and a little bit the shape of things that are going to jump up in your face and ruin your day, you start going like, oh, I remember, this is just like this other thing, and it tends to be a little less panic-inducing, I think.
Definitely. I think that when we look at the quote-unquote, and I'm doing big air quotes here, problems that we run into today, I mean, it pales by comparison to trying to, you know, get three tape machines, you know, with a RS-422 cable on the back of them to roll in sync with each other and not have your not have your preview slip too much.
It's of course expectations have risen to match, so it's a dead heat as far as I'm concerned. It's you know, there's always going to be something, but things that really blow my mind is that once you memorize enough of the specs, there are certain things that drag. You know, I know that some people like, for example, some people say things like 29.97, that's so sloppy. When are we going to get rid of those decimal points? Shouldn't we just be shooting 30.0? And I go like, yeah, that would be great, but there's a certain amount of set in stone stuff that you just have to appreciate, and it's sort of like asking, I don't know, this isn't exactly, but you know, well, why aren't there 100 seconds in a minute? Why didn't we fix that? And at some point, you just roll with it, and then you start realizing that some of those weird little numbers start showing up again and again and again. In terms of understanding why things are the way they are, because in a lot of, you know, most of the time you say, why the hell is this working this way? And it's not an intuitive answer, and it's not very comforting. But
well, it's complicated. I mean, let's face it. How many people do you know that can truly explain why we use numbers like 29.97? How many people can really explain, oh, well, if it was 30 frames per second, guess what? You wouldn't be able to fit all your hours in a day. Huh?
Exactly, right?
I don't get it. I know. Just trust me. It's 29.97.
I've heard a number of stories, and a lot of them, you know, they were sort of, you know, told to me by another technician. So I'm never entirely certain if somebody was just yanking my chain or not. But I go back to Wikipedia, and it's normally close enough. But there's a lot of great reasons why they were. And usually whenever you find a compromise in a spec, there's usually somebody back then, you know, back in time, some engineer just sweating it out, going like, well, I could do it this way, and it might be a little bit easier, but then we'd lose out this. And you usually find out what the cost was for, and then it's somewhat amazing. Right. I mean, the way that I heard it told, and I won't go in too great detail because it'd be silly, but if you want 30.0,
I think it'd be a great podcast.
Well, if you want 30.0 frames per second to have occurred at the time that it did with the technology that was available then pretty much you wouldn't have had color television for a lot longer. Color TV wouldn't have come along until a lot later.
Actually, you know, come to think of it, I don't know that I've never heard that. That's interesting.
Right. Well, I'll leave it to your readers to do the Wikipedia essay and figure it out. But that's the way I heard it. And there's a but that essentially was tied to the development of color television.
Yeah.
And the way to get three signals into one.
I will find an explanation for it and post it on the show notes for this episode. So did you get into Avid very early then, in the early 90s?
I didn't get in until about 1996, and that was as an assistant. So what maybe 95.
What were you doing in the early 90s then?
Well, I was transitioning out of production, and I got involved in an independent feature film that was being cut over at the Bay Area Video Coalition back when it was on 17th Street down south of Market over in the Potrero Hill area. And oftentimes that meant digitizing Beta SP tapes in late at night. And also I did a bit of I did a lot of voiceover. It was pretty fun. It was a documentary about Russia, and so they often needed me to read in recreation voices. So I'd be there alone at night listening to the machines hum while doing Russian accent into microphone.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were doing that. So how did you get into and you did some assisting. So how did you what was the first time? What was it like the first time you walked into a suite, you sat down, and you were the guy? It's like, okay, Jesse, this is your session. Don't screw it up. Do you remember that?
Well, yeah, but I would say that, you know, the way I've approached all the technology that I have is that, you know, while I was assisting, to me, getting any kind of assistant job for me was like, I didn't care as long as it didn't cost me money to do it, because I would then just spend the rest of the time goofing around on the machine.
Right.
And learning. So, of course, there was definitely something when you have your first session that you have to accommodate another person and sort of be on stage a little bit more. But I had already put the Avid through most of the paces that I cared about, and I always would just, you know, make some sort of little project or something just to make sure I was on top of what I needed to do. And that's kind of what I still do, is if I've got a new piece of software, is I try to learn it, but then I try to just take something from Alpha through to Omega and make it happen, because then there isn't a missed step in the pipeline that, you know.
Exactly. I think that's the thing that bags a lot of people, is they'll I mean, it could be as simple as listening to the marketing hype or you know, messing around with something but never actually trying to, you know, export it and deliver it or, you know, whatever. But it's so often where you can find yourself, you know, stubbing your toe on something because you weren't diligent. You know, you didn't think through your pipeline.
Yeah, it's kind of like you've got this pipe and you build it, and then you got to take a bent coat hanger and send it through with a bit of string and then see if you can pull a string all the way through it.
Right.
And if you can do that, then you know that you've kind of got something. And the other thing is that unless you're actually in a creative situation, if you're just putting up dummy text in order to do something, unless you're, you know, investigating creative things and putting your own investment in it, you know, you're not going to be faced with the, oh, I really would love it if I could just do an asymmetrical trim here. I better really figure out how to do that. You know, there's, you know, just put a little skin in the game. And, you know, I know that not everybody does this, but I think it's really healthy to do personal work. Now, you don't have to do a lot of it, but it's worth doing just so that you have something to do while you're testing to some extent.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that, I, you know, and I've said this many times publicly, I think that one of the things that stretches us the most is our passion projects. And as a hired gun, we walk into suites and we are asked to, you know, use our skills and abilities and experience and knowledge to further somebody else's idea and or project.
Or agenda. Yeah, yeah.
Or agenda, yeah. And I think that there is, you know, there's a little bit of selling of your soul when it comes to doing that. And I think that if you do it too long, you will find yourself being very empty one day, you know? And I think it's really important. And whether it's like getting involved in like a 48-hour film festival or just, you know, just shooting your dog running down the beach and then cutting it together to whatever. I mean, there comes a time where you have to have full control over something, because if, you know, you said it yourself, I got into this because I wanted to make movies.
Yeah.
You know, nobody sits down and says, you know what I really want to do for a living? I want to sit in a dark room and I want to have people that know less than me sit behind me and tell me what to do all day long. That would be awesome.
Yeah, I've been there. Every now and then I say, like, man, I stood in the wrong line back on career day. Had I known that the person was calling the shots was not the editor, I might have thought twice.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm really lucky. There's been a lot of work I've done over the years where it's, you know, you're just selling your skills to help somebody else's agenda. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're selling your soul, but, you know, editing is ultimately making a lot of choices to influence and manipulate people's understanding and sometimes emotions. And there's, I don't believe that editors can Manchurian candidate people by putting flash frames in and stuff like that. But I do think that when you combine concrete information along with less abstract and more visual things, like just sensations of music and sound and the emotions that come from certain colors and pacing by changing things, you are essentially being asked to be a bit of a, you know, a sociopath, to measure every decision to the point where all you're trying to do is influence somebody else's message, you know?
Yeah.
I'm lucky enough that I never took the type of job where I felt completely uncomfortable about what that message was. Then again, I've also been very lucky that in recent years, I've been able to more or less choose the type of people that I get to work with and therefore support their messages just by taking the jobs that I take.
Okay. I like what you're saying, but I would like to touch a little bit more on this Manchurian candidate thing, because I think it is interesting, and I think that as editors, I think sometimes maybe we're sometimes we're a little delusional in terms of like how much we really can influence people. But let's face it, there are ways to present and pace something that works better than others.
Well, I'll tell you that one of the first things that I did when I got my hands on anything, like first the RM450 and the linear tape decks, that one couldn't do single frame edits that well. But the Avid, I did a whole piece where it was just like single frame edits. And I really wanted to know, can I put those subliminal messages in there? And I was like, I can see them. I can see them there. They're there. And in the long run, I think that there's a lot of wish fulfillment about what film and video can and can't do. And you know, people in our industry specifically make it a little confusing. We use a lot of terms to protect our own jobs that, you know, talk about, well, you know, you have to know about story and you have to know about flow. And it's there's a lot of big words that are often used to sort of add value to it. But at the same time, I mean, I remember I was talking to somebody, they were a junior editor, and they were doing a simple, like, corporate piece, and they were confused where to start. I said, like, you know, start with the talking heads and cut it until it makes sense, and then where it doesn't look good, just put B-roll on top of it, and that's editing.
Pretty much.
Well, and oftentimes it really is. It's there's many steps and many disciplines. But I don't see any reason to make it seem mystical or magical. I think that you can do mystical and magical work, but generally you can't do mystical and magical work if you're given garbage with, you know, footage to begin with.
It sure is a lot nicer when you have better pictures to work with. I'll say that.
When you're collaborating, you have good ingredients, you can make something wonderful, and I guess you could say transcendent, in as much as that, like, well, it's more than just pictures and sounds in a linear playback fashion, because that's all it is. It's pictures and sounds being played back in a specific order that you chose.
You know, one of my favorite producers that I've ever had the privilege of working with, I'm not going to say who it is, but she, you know, she was really interesting. She spent about 90% of her time on what some people refer to as the radio edit, you know, the content.
Right.
And we just pounded on this interview, these interviews, like, okay, I want to take this prepositional phrase and put it before this and change this verb, and we're going to, like, oh my goodness, we completely changed.
Oh, you Frankensteined it.
Totally. We completely changed what this guy was saying, and we shaped it into the message that they needed, that they were absolutely going to walk out with. And we, and like I said, she spent about 80 to 90% of her time on that. And we had this complete Frankenstein edit in front of us. And then she looked at the clock and she's like, ugh, I got to catch Bart. Lather that thing up with some B-roll and post it for me to check out later. You know? I think she even said the word lather.
Lather, right, right, sure.
But basically, it was like, if the message is right, if that spine is proper, I know the shooter took pretty pictures and, you know, just have it make sense. And I think some of that had to do with the fact that she trusted me, and that was an honor because I'm a huge fan of her work. But it was kind of interesting to me because other producers I know, they want to, like, you know, argue to the carpet, you know, every shot in sequence, you know, and there's a place for all of that, you know, and there really isn't a wrong way and a right way, but it's interesting how different producers have different, you know, not only styles, but just strategies to get through the edit. Do you ever find that when you're, kind of, you know, doing one of those Frankenstein edits like we were talking about, and do you ever find that you purposely leave in little bobbles so they do sound more human? You said sometimes it feels too manufactured.
Yeah. Well, most of the time I have to do a Frankenstein edit, it's usually not because that they are not on message. It's usually because they're not concise.
True.
Or
you want to cut to the chase,
or they have, see, I'm very conscious of it now because I know what's wrong, but having to do it while you're actually speaking. For example, the thing you don't want to have is people who get to the end of a sentence and then, you know, quickly get to the next thing because there's no way to reduce it, you know, right. And they kind of lead, and there's a tonality that you just can't cut around, and you kind of have to leave it in place. So normally when I have a Franken edit, there's usually a few pauses that you got to leave in place just so that – otherwise it sounds – if you Franken edit too much, you get somebody who's talking but not breathing in between, and the audience actually starts feeling a little uncomfortable. They start going, how is he talking so long?
Yeah. I think one of the things that I try and fight for on occasion – And you get it all the time. People say, "Oh, I need to take that stumble out, or I'm actually doing it. That stutter,
right?
You know, and some of those things, like when you leave those in, it actually makes the edit feel a lot smoother. I mean, I'll tell the people who listen to these shows. And I will say, not as much on this show, Final Cut Grill, but on our other podcast, Digital Cinema Cafe, there's actually quite a few edits in that show. And it feels – we try to make it feel like a very natural conversation, but I will fess up. There's a ton of edits in those shows. And in doing a pure audio edit, which I have – you know, this is new to me. Editing purely audio is something that it's new to me in the last year. And, you know, mm-hmm. When we're cutting heads, we're thinking about jump cuts. I'm gonna have to cover that. And the other thing is, it's different cutting in an audio editor than it is in a video editor because it's more precise.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I've noticed that, you know, in the process of editing dialogue, pure dialogue, like in these podcasts, it's a totally different world. And it's been fun to leave some of those little stutters and bobbles in because it disguises the edit. You know, you don't expect there to be an edit there when there was a little bit of a flub. You know?
Sure. Well, that would be the the sociopathic manipulator that you are.
Why, thank you.
That's like, you know, if there's a client and I really want their money and I'm scared they think I'm too smart, I might mispronounce a few words just to seal the deal. Just to make them feel a little smarter than they are.
Okay, yeah, this is a good place to make a transition, because last Thursday night at Cutter's, you and I started a conversation in the back of the room. And
it was a pretty mean-spirited conversation, but yeah.
Well, no, it was actually quite interesting, because you had relayed a story about an edit that had it had gotten a little bit off track, and some of the things that you were saying were like, God, you know, that's like really, really good advice. So I don't want to get anybody in trouble, especially you.
Sure.
And so, you know, you don't have to say anybody, and you can be as vague as you want. But can you relay some of that story that you told me last week?
The trouble is that it could be one of three clients right now that I was complaining about, and I honestly don't remember which one it was.
Okay,
refresh my memory.
Refreshing your memory, I think it was a director and a producer who were not seeing eye to eye, and their changes were going to run out the budget.
Oh, right.
Classic problem. You know, you take on a job, you bid an amount or a certain amount of time, or they tell you what they have and you decide whether or not you want to take it. And, you know, I always say that, you know, editing is like being a cab driver. You know, it's fine. I will drive you anywhere you want in the city as long as the flag is up.
I prefer an hourly rate as well. See, I understand the producer's perspective. The producers certainly like flat rates because, to be honest, then it's easier to count and be accountable for the money. Whereas an hourly rate means you can spend as little or as much as you want. My perspective, well, it's self-preservation to want to do hourly because ultimately I only have my time to sell. And also because, well, this was particularly for finishing work, and I think that sometimes people imagine that finishing work is more finite than it is. People tend to realize that, you know, the creative offline edit is that could take a little bit of time or a lot of amount of time. They understand that sometimes you have to throw more money, but the finishing, they sometimes get surprised that there are as many forks in the road. And you know, if you have more hours and you have the budget for it, then you can review more options and get to make more choices before you run out. If you don't, then it takes less. But there is an infinite amount to it, and something has to govern when it's done, you know?
Right. And I think that that's the fear, you know, and getting back to the cab thing, you know, if you get in a cab at SFO and say, I want to go to North Beach, how much? And the guy says, well, $40. You go, cool. And then you say, hey, can we just, I've never driven over the Golden Gate Bridge. Can we do that too? It's like, no, I already gave you a price. You know, you're changing the scope of the job at that point. And I think that's the thing that bothers me. So you ended up having to have a powwow with these two guys. How did you solve the problem? Because they were pulling you in different directions in this.
Well, they actually, this particular job, they were actually being very well behaved. Oftentimes, the thing though is that if you're paying hourly, you certainly got to make them aware of the meter running. If they can't see the meter running like you can in a cab, and then suddenly the amount is more than they were expecting, I understand why they'd be upset. So at that point, what I heard was a difference of opinions, and I myself started going, oh, well, I think we're not on his track before, and we have enough of the budget left, but not enough to have
– to do both of these.
Yeah, to not have a push-me-pull-you kind of thing. So what I did was I sent them an invoice and said, okay, well, here we are.
Yeah.
And I said, and I'm not giving this to you to draw a line in the sand, but to help you manage your own resources. And the thing is that I honestly don't know if I did a very good job there. I thought I had the right tone of voice, but the thing is, if somebody gives you a hard number, like, well, here's how much gas is left in the tank, it is this slightly cold maneuver. We were saying, like, hey, argue with the numbers. But at the same time, the only thing I can do is enable other people to have the power for the choices. I try to not take choices away as much as try to put like levers into people's handles so that they can pull the levers they want to, you know?
Right, right.
And sometimes you can't give them every option and every lever, but in the long run, I tried to present it in a way that was like, this is what you want. This is what I think you want. You want to be able to control this so that you know, and that way you don't have to worry about whether it's getting done or not. But it is hard because numbers are hard, and it's an expensive business. An expensive business. And things were fine. We came to an accord very quickly, but it's I believe that also the situation had been that I had said, well, here's the time it generically takes and here's the time I think we're going to take, but it could take a lot longer or a lot less.
Right.
You know what? Maybe something that when you flat rate something, it seems to me – I don't know. It seems kind of weirdly dishonest to me because if you ask me for a flat rate – what I'm probably going to do is think about how much 5 days worth of money generally costs me. And then I'm going to do my damnedest to get the job done in three.
Right.
And have some profit. So it kind of means from the get go, I'm trying to be pushy and rush choices that if they were governing their own time, they would spend more time doing. And instead I would just be shuffling them along, you know?
I don't think a lot of people really think through that aspect of it.
Well, there are some producers who do this all the time. I work with a lot of producers who do it for the first time, and to some extent, I have to eat a few half hours here and sometimes half days, in the same way that like the kids in the ice cream store and the ice cream falls off and. It's just no good for business. If you have like a crying kid in your ice cream store.
Yeah.
So I do kind of make it my specialty to work with, you know, first time filmmakers. So I really try to account for that and try to make up for some of the indifference and horribleness of the world. Of course I can't do it too far and I have to be really careful that they don't then expect that everything comes to them for free.
Right. Right. And I think that's something that, you know, it's really easy in this business. Or the worst part is I think, you know, well, you know, I worked with so and so and he didn't charge me for any of that. I go, yeah, okay, so why aren't you with him today? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I'm not the right guy for you to be working with today.
Yeah, money can be really frustrating and my favorite clients like get discounts all the time. You know, I don't charge them to post. I don't charge them if I got to come home early and start a render before I go to bed. I don't charge them if, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of things that I do for them because I enjoy pleasant company. And these are the same people who routinely buy lunch. And the thing is like the lunch they buy me is not close to my hourly. But it's a friendly thing to do, and they make the work tolerable. And that stuff pays them back. Or I should say this. I have to have faith that stuff pays them back, and the world gets a little bit better because of it. It certainly means that I have a better chance of working with people that are good. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I always say companies don't hire companies. People hire people. You know,
and
you have to realize when you start a session with somebody that's going to be multiple days, and you know, I know that you do, you know, films and stuff, and I got news to, I have no idea how you do that for, you know, months on end or whatever. Dude. But you're committed. You're going to be with that person for a lot of time.
That's the other thing is that there is a certain amount of – I think that's something that adds to the mix. If you are in charge of money as well as the working with the person, if you're a freelancer or if you have a small shop.
Right.
I mean, you really count on having a good, nearly psychic rapport. You make this whole lookup table in your brain so that when they say punchy, you know that they want you to cut every shot two frames shorter. And what you try to be the best cat's paw to exert their will that you can.
What's a cat's paw?
And that's a nicely intimate rapport, and I enjoy it. But when suddenly you find in disagreement over the money and your compensation, it does sting doubly because it feels sometimes a little bit more like a betrayal to both sides.
Let's talk a little bit about hardware. You know, this show is called Final Cut Grill, and I know
that, I know.
And that's fine. That's fine. And I know that you don't use Final Cut 10, but I was actually kind of a little surprised the other night because you had said something about, you know, I think you had looked at it and you were intrigued by it. What do you think of Final Cut 10?
Well, I poked at it when it first came out.
Yeah,
and
that was a mistake.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, the thing is that I didn't have to approach it with the same guarded fear that a lot of people did because, I mean, my thought had been that I was going to start receiving Final Cut Pro X work immediately. And when that wasn't the case, it meant that I had time to deal with it. And I'll actually do a little Apple bashing right now.
Go for it.
So
sorry, Apple, but
sorry, Apple. This is actually a begrudging compliment. I think that Apple comes out with products that don't work, but almost work. And then everybody else goes, that's exactly the way things should work. And then Apple has time because they're already the industry leader. Everybody else is labeled a copycat. And then they get it to actually work. The gag was that they had the first phone that wasn't a phone, you know? And there is a certain amount of like, well, they get to be then the design leader. And it's kind of nice that they get to come up with the accolades for all the things that are cool without actually having to functionally fix everything out to begin with. So routinely the thing is like, well, I certainly am dedicated to Apple products, or I should say I'm dedicated to any Apple product that's version 4 or later. There's a tipping point, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And once it's there, let all those people who need to rush in and have an opinion and be pioneers, I'll let them take the bruises. That's
right.
Okay.
Right, right, right.
But I needed to know what was different about it. I mean, I have done some Final Cut X work, but it's all been personal. I cut my latest demo reel on Final Cut X.
Oh, cool. I think that's a great way to dip your toe in, frankly.
Right, right. It's a good exercise, and it gets you up there. And there's so much that's fantastic about Final Cut X, and the things that I like the most, and it has to do with the fact that Apple is not beholden to actually putting out a functional product, is – they get to break the mold. There's I look around other NLE interfaces, and some of the things that I find charming are like, there are still icons on most interfaces that look like little cassettes somewhere, or little phonograph records, or all sorts of actual devices that we don't actually use anymore.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And we should be shedding the dead weight. I in some ways, I keep going, oh, they didn't change Final Cut X enough. We still have a timeline. What are we, running upright moviolas? You know,
can you come up with a better metaphor than a timeline?
I can't. But what I admired was the fact that they kissed goodbye so much stuff. And when I thought about it, a lot of the stuff was like, yeah, that always was kind of stupid. Or just seemed like a throwback. And I'm glad that somebody was pioneering and finding new ways to get stuff done.
So when you did your edit, your demo reel, what did you appreciate? What annoyed you?
So here's my ignorance being laid bare. There's probably like a single keystroke that'll solve most of this.
Maybe. It's fine.
My demo reels are basically sizzles. They're not really excerpted. So I take out all the natural sound from the picture clips.
Okay.
And what I do is I generically just have a bed of music, and I like to think that I have a variety of work to show off, so I usually go through two or three pieces of music, and each piece of music is going to be stitched short, and in some places might be looped, and in some places I'm holding off on a big crescendo until
an explosion or whatever,
explosive shot, so that I end up with a very, hopefully very fast pace and visually dynamic sizzle reel. So I found that when making audio edits internally, it was difficult to then marry them to the clips, because there's the really kind of clever thing about the way you can just sync audio and video together, and no matter where you slug it around, it shifts around.
Right.
But in this case, I wanted to really make a perfect music edit.
Right.
And then I also wished to have the flexibility that if one segment was running long, I want to be able to sync multiple audio edits to the head of certain clips, but also have it liquid. And in the long run,
that's a neat idea, actually. So in Final Cut 10 per parlance, you're talking about the connected clip, where
correct.
When you drop a piece of B-roll on top of your A-roll, let's say, it will on its first frame, it'll go, hey, I'm gonna kind of parent myself to this thing, this frame. But if you're dealing with a long cut of music, you might.
Well, I got the job done by connecting to a series of dummy clips and fillers.
Oh, that's
and
clever.
I didn't find that. My sense was that there was a more elegant way to achieve what I had done, and I hadn't discovered it. So it wasn't like, screw this damn Final Cut X. It doesn't do what I want to do. It's more like, well, it operates in a different way. And if I was doing a different kind of job, I probably would have been very much appreciating the functions that I was having difficulty with.
Right. You know, one of the ways that I deal with music, and I really like cutting music in Final Cut 10. I've talked about it a lot. And I love the fact that basically, you know, when you're cutting, you know, if you call that delineator between your video and audio, I think of that like in Final Cut 7, that was like the equator. So anything above the equator is all my video tracks.
Right.
Anything below the equator is all my audio tracks. But when you're cutting a pure music piece, a music clip rather, in Final Cut 10, you're actually being able to edit that thing at the subframe level, even though it's in a video project. And what that means is if you drop markers down on that thing, you know, just listening to the beat or whatever, those markers will almost certainly fall between your frame count on a video clip. And that's really advantageous when you are cutting music. And, you know, one of the things that I recognized right away is that cutting music was a lot easier in Final Cut 10. I found myself dropping in little two-frame cross dissolves a lot less because I didn't need to.
Right.
You know, so what I'll do is what I typically do is I'll drop a cut of music in, and then immediately it's a Command G. I put it in its own storyline. And what that means is if I want to, like you talked about looping and shortening. So if you find like a four count that you want to loop, you drop markers to the beat of the music and 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2. Okay. Now you put your blade cuts or whatever on those markers. And just like any drawing program, like if you were in Adobe Illustrator and you want to drag off a copy of a square, you hold down the Command key and you click on it and you drag it off. You drag a copy off. Well, you can do the same thing with a little video audio loop, and you drag a copy of that four count loop off. And because it's in its own storyline, when you go to drop it at the end of the first loop, it pushes the tail end out. So it's really easy to like extendicate something.
Right.
Or, you know, if let's say, okay, I'm going to cut a verse out. You know, here's my mark, select it and delete it. And that storyline will act like its own little, quote unquote, magnetic timeline. So I find it really easy to lengthen and shorten music in that fashion.
Where's that plugin? I bet you somebody's doing that.
What's that?
Well, there's a lot of plugins for a lot of NLEs where they're doing voice recognition and doing transcribing. Where's the one that picks out the intro, the verse, the chorus, the middle eight, and you just open up a metadata window and say repeat middle eight twice?
I'm going to do something that premiumbeat.com sponsors this show.
Oh, and did I just plug?
You totally plugged, because one of the things that they have, and I say this all the time, but it's totally true. I am in love with premiumbeat.com, because one of the things that you can do with their tracks is that they'll sell the full track, which is like 3 minutes, and then they have what are called loop sets or loop packs. I can't remember what they call it. It's the loops, and basically it's like little audio Legos.
Oh, sure.
And so you start with number one and end with number 12, and then you have 2 through 11, and you can like stretch and extend and move them around, and I can have a little downbeat section here, and I can have a stronger beat here, and I can it's cool.
Well, I think that if I can make my own music, one of the things I'm helping do is, you know, most musicians I know have too much money. So if I can cut them out of the loop, I'm really going to go for that.
I'm not making music. Actually, these guys get paid. These musicians get paid. They're not giving away music at Premium Beat, although it is very competitively priced. But anyway, that's our commercial. I'm totally in love with Premium Beat. And then the other thing that I do with their stuff on occasion, so they have they'll sell you the music, they'll sell you the loop pack, and then they sell you what is called shorts. So they have like a 15, a 30, and a 60. It's pre-built to be the proper length. And a lot of times the intro and outro, or the first and last four counts, whatever, on those shorts is much different than the original song. And so you might get a different sting at the end or whatever. So it's musical Legos, and I'm totally in love with them.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it's really cool. So that's the end of the commercial. But I'm a huge fan, and they support the show. So I ask everybody to please go support Premium Beat. So we were talking about music. So that was one of the things that I can't remember. Was that one of the things that you found to be annoying or that you liked? You kind of liked the connected clip, but it was sort of a pain.
Well, in most cases, when I was exploring the tool, it's that feeling of, oh, what does this do? What things does this make easier? And what old habits, maybe what old workarounds am I used to doing that this obviates?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of general clumsiness. So the thing was that I wanted certain things to be absolutely locked, but I also wanted things absolutely to be liquid. And in some ways, what I wanted may have been entirely incompatible with any system. But it had to do with, I wanted to have certain places sync up and others not, and yet I wanted to be able to, each new piece of music had to coincide with the start of a next, the head of the next film clip for the next section.
Right.
And also oftentimes I would need the new piece of music to be tied to the outro of another piece of music so that the rhythm going out matched the rhythm going in. But then I also had it stapled down at the beginning, and that meant that the middle chunks where I was looping stuff around sometimes would get displaced at the head, sometimes at the tail.
Right.
Like I said, largely I found a workaround, and I was aware that I may have been asking for something that was sort of having your cake and eat it too. But that was something that I was curious about. The other thing that it's not so much that I was curious. It was something I knew I did not get to the bottom of, and that there was a cleverer way to do it. You know?
Don't you hate that feeling? So what was it?
Well, it's a little bit easier to, you know, it's a little bit easier to take that one on than like, ah, this sucks, everything sucks. It's just more like it's a mystery, and most of the things you got to do are a mystery, you know. The other thing that like I didn't get way on top of, but I was really impressed by, was I knew that the skimmer versus the playhead, that at some point, if I had more time on that, that was going to be, I was sitting there going, two playheads are better than one. This is brilliant. It's where I want it to be, even though I'm moving this to touch with this, but the playhead is still where I want it. And I wasn't entirely, I was sort of confused and disoriented oftentimes when I sat down, but every time I went back to Final Cut 7 or Avid, I sat there and just looked at you like you poor one-handed child. There's a whole other way you could be doing this. You could be tying your shoes if you had two hands.
Yeah. Actually, that's a really good description. I've never thought of the playhead and the skimmer as being like two hands, but that's a really good analogy. Very interesting. Yeah. So, and I think what you're saying is you see those and you're like, oh, this is really cool. I don't know exactly how I would use this on a day-to-day basis, but I get it. This is better. Is that kind of what you were saying?
Yeah. And, you know, maybe I'll admit that the things that I enjoy, I may simply have enjoyed the fact that things were shaken up a bit and forced me to reevaluate how I put things together.
Yeah.
But the thing is that there's so many marvelous tools that are in there, and the entire new way that things are, you know, essentially your media is all now hashtags, you know, yeah. As opposed to bins that have to mesh up with some other person's sense of organization. There's something in the new organizational scheme that looks forward thinking to jobs that have more footage than you would ever have before, because projects get bigger and bigger all the time.
Right. Yeah, when I look at my own personal understanding of bins versus keyword collections, is what we call them in the Final Cut 10, it took me a while. Like at first I was like, I just hate this. What's going on? Because, you know, you'd make a keyword collection and in your mind you're thinking, well, it's kind of like a bin. And so I want to drag this piece of clip into that bin. And you can't do it. You can't put it into the field or the search result. But what you can do is take a clip and drag it on top of the actual name of the keyword collection, because that's like assigning that keyword collection. And so really in Final Cut 10, everything is in one giant bucket. And whether you're using the keyword collections or the smart collections – or even the search field up at the top of the browser, or even, and I don't even know what they call it, but it's a place where you can select like favorites or rejected or whatever. All of those are different ways to filter your view of everything that's in the giant bucket. And when you kind of wrap your head around the fact that I can put things, quote unquote, put, giant air quotes here, when I can assign multiple keyword collections to one piece of media, that's where, like, for me, it like kind of blew my mind. It's like, oh, I can say these are all the shots of black cars. These are all the shots I did on Tuesday night. And these are all the shots of cars with their headlights on. And now I can like cross-reference them. I might have a car that was shot on Tuesday night with the headlights on, and it appears in all three of those search strings, you know? And when you get that, you're like, oh, okay, this is a whole new way of thinking about, you know, media and data and an organization.
It is. I think it's many interfaces are based around metaphors that you can point to with physical objects. Folders and folders and folders, bins and bins and bins. You know, you can imagine a series of nesting cardboard boxes. And some cardboard boxes contain items, and some cardboard boxes contain other boxes and items. But there is a certain it's hard to pin a real-world metaphor.
That's a good point.
And I think that it's difficult because when you want to talk about it or convey it to somebody about why it's good, you have to just start off saying, imagine everything's connected to everything by microscopic black holes that you assign name to. And it's a difficult conversation starter.
You know, I mean, think about this. Do you remember like in the earliest days of the internet, and what was Apple? Apple had like an online community thing called like Apple World or eWorld or something like that. I can't remember what it was. Mm-hmm. But in the earliest days of the internet, everybody's user interfaces involved like a cartoonish world. You know, there was like a caricature of like a town square. So if I wanted to look up some information, I would click on the library. And if I wanted to, you know, chat with people, I would click on the whatever, some icon that meant, you know, the hangout or, you know, the coffee shop or something like that. Or if I wanted to purchase an airplane ticket, I would click on the, you know, through Sabre or whatever it was. Guy, I'm dating myself, you know, 20 years ago. But you'd click on an image that was a caricature or a representation of, like what you were just saying, a real world thing.
Right.
And yet today we're all pretty comfortable with the little Google box, you know?
Well, you know, I might extend and this is not because I think that Final Cut Pro X has this problem, but I believe that Final Cut Pro X phobics have this type of worry. I can type into Google anything and I will get something that will match. But when you're in the edit chair, you often have somebody cracking the whip over your head, and they want to see every example of that in one place, in a finite way, so you can review it and absolutely ascertain that you've chosen the best one. Right. And it's not that that's beyond Final Cut Pro X's abilities by any means. It's absolutely doable. But that sense that everything is sort of out there and you're reliant on keywords, I think is a little bit, you know, I haven't dug in close enough. Maybe you can tell me what happens if you have one of these multiple terabyte jobs and it's interviews right. with the same person, maybe over 2 or 3 years.
Right, right.
And the assistant editor keywords logged everything and misspelled the name. So you have 2 or 3 different spellings of the names.
Yeah.
I can imagine that that's the type of reconciliation thing that people are scared about, that it's a that you have to know what the keywords are in order to find them and fix them, so that if there's mistagging.
Yeah. So let me address that for just a little bit here, just in defense of the product.
Absolutely.
So anything that is a keyword is going to show up in your library window. So if you have, you know, 1,000 keywords and you spell Smith S-M-I-T-H and S-M-Y-T-H-E, or S-M-Y-T-H, you know, you're going to see those. So you'll know, you'll look at it and you go, oh, that's kind of a problem, isn't it? And then the other thing is...
Sure.
And
let me ask you this. Okay. In my iTunes, I know that I have birds, comma, the, and the yeah. birds. And it might take me a long time to realize that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because one is in the B's and one is in the T's.
Well, my suspicion is that it's not that big of a problem for smaller projects because they're a little bit more graspable and your entire keyword search could be there.
But again, if you use the find command, the find box,
right.
and just type BYRDS, you're going to find all of them, whether it is birds or the birds or birds, comma, the. All right. of them that say birds. So that's one way that kind of saves your bacon. And then the other thing to keep in mind, and I think that, you know, I've been cutting in Final Cut 10 for 2 years now, and I still have to remind myself of this, is that although everything can have a keyword, things do not actually have to have a keyword. And so sometimes clicking on the what is called the event icon, that will show you absolutely everything that is in the project. And then you can actually search for, you can narrow your search by saying, just show me stuff that actually doesn't have a keyword. Okay. So again, that's another sort of database sort of tool where you can go, oh, look at this. My assistant didn't appropriately keyword a whole day's worth of shooting.
Right.
You know? So, and you know, it's true. If you just want to, you know, cut with U-matic tape decks, you know, this is not the tool for you. If you're not interested in, you know, sort of stretching, you know, yourself a little bit, you know, maybe you should still be cutting in Final Cut 7. But there are so many tools like that in this thing where you go, God, you know what? Like you said, it's like having the skimmer and the playhead. You poor bastard, you have only one hand now.
Right, right.
You know?
There's also a sense, I know that I've done some jobs where it's been, there's three tapes, and I don't do any sub-clipping, and I don't do any naming, it just ends up all getting slugged in.
Yep.
And I think that there are some people who never learn to not edit that way. And right, so the concept right. of stopping and being a competent assistant editor and getting things tagged appropriately, they see that as a deficit, but largely because they're not taking full advantage of their tools anyway.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And then the other thing, and I don't know if you know this, but do you know that you can do what's called range-based keywords? So you take that, you know, one-hour tape that got digitized right. or that, you know, 60-minute clip that got recorded into a Key Pro.
So you can set a range and then just find the sub clips that have
yeah. So I can start shuttling through it and go, oh, this is good in out. I can either give it a keyword, you know, like, you know, you know, smiles, you know, right. I've told this story many times, but I'll tell you, cause I don't think you've heard it. I did a show a couple summers ago, for BMW driving across country, and the producers early in the event said, oh, and by the way, like in the last few days, we're going to do a little meltdown of all the people who brought their pets along. It's like, oh, okay. So as I was going through footage for 2 weeks in a tour bus driving through the heartland, I was like, oh, there's somebody's dog in, out, you know, I start to type P for pets. And it goes, oh, you want to keyword that with pets? Yes, I do. And boom, it goes into the pets thing. So like a week and a half later, producer walks into the tour bus one morning and she goes, hey, let's do that pet video today. Okay. And it was, and I had snipped out little tiny clips of people and their dogs out of larger shots.
I have done that. It's fantastic.
And then, and now all of a sudden,
drag everything and blam, you've got it.
Exactly.
Done in
I open up a blank timeline, go to that keyword selection, select all, hit the letter E to drop it into the timeline. Okay, what else do you want to work on today? You know, done. And so that's like a really powerful thing because, again, every one of those clips could have been stored, you know, in like my Wednesday morning stuff or my driving through the cornfield stuff or however I want to sort it. But if there's one shot of a dog hanging his head out the window, I'm like, oh, there's a pet shot. Boom. And now it's keyworded and stored in or searchable. Through different, it, that's the other thing. You don't store it, but you choose how you're going to search for it. But
yes,
anyway,
yes.
I think what's interesting is that in the little bit that you've played with it, I think you get it. And frankly, I think a lot of people can't get to even where you are. You know?
Sure.
They just see, up, oh, different. Nope, not for me. I'm out. Tag. Give me Final Cut 7.
There's something, you know, we've talked a little bit about this, but privately. But my sense is that there's a million ways to edit, as many ways to edit as there are editors. But there is, you know, when you're sitting and doing some type of work, sometimes it is radio edit the A roll, paint it over the B roll, and you're donezies. If you're doing a narrative feature, I mean, you literally sort everything almost, you know, alphabetically. You start with scene one, take right. one, right. you know, angle A, and you work your way downstream, and it's paint by numbers. And then you do a series of trims as you tighten up and swap out shots. There's a zillion different philosophies about how to build stuff. You know, some people, if they've got a montage or a sizzle, they take all their best clips and stick it into a timeline and then reduce down, reduce down, reduce down, reduce down. And it's not that they – all of them are valid ways to edit, and in a lot of ways, different jobs require different techniques. People tend to poo-poo a new product if it does not directly address their favorite way of editing.
Yeah, totally.
That's okay, because if a tool is better for what you do, you know, that's great. Use that tool. But it's sort of incorrect to assume that everybody edits the way you do and everybody finds the same things efficient or inefficient that you do.
Which, you know, how difficult would it be if all of a sudden Jesse got the phone call from Apple saying, okay, yeah, so you're in charge now. Make a brand new editor. It's like, oh, gee, I don't want that job.
Yeah, make it better. There is something I don't know what Final Cut Pro X's fate is going to be. It seems horribly maligned, and everybody who has discovered the benefits, of which there are many, of working with Final Cut Pro X are continuously having to defend it and just really be defensive about it.
Right.
Because when, you know, one of the least admirable traits I've found about a lot of editors is that a lot of them cannot say, I don't like that editing system. It's not right for me. And they end up saying, that's not a good editing tool. It's for unprofessional editors. If you use it, you are not as good an editor as I am.
Right, right, right.
And that is, I don't understand how people can say that. It's,
you know,
I mean, we all like to make jokes about Vegas, but there are people doing great work every day, 9 to 5 with Vegas. I don't know what jobs they do. I don't think I have those jobs.
Not the city of Vegas, right?
Sorry?
I said, you're talking about Sony Vegas, not the city of Vegas.
I was talking about the city of Vegas. No, I'm talking about Sony Vegas.
Yeah, Sony Vegas really is the punchline for all editors, isn't it?
It's. I think that I'm just do a little, you know, a little clap there for all the unsung Vegas editors, because I'm sure there are plenty of them who are doing great work. I've never had to use it. I'm a Mac based guy, so if I had a PC, I probably would get it just to see what it's about and figure it out.
Right.
But it's something that it really does exist as a punchline, but I have no idea whether it deserves to be a punchline or not. I suspect it doesn't. And I suspect the people who work with Vegas, even if Vegas isn't the greatest, they're still doing great work. So it's like, I just really hate it when people transfer their fear or distrust of an application onto the users. That just seems...
Yeah, and I think, you know, to wrap this up, I think the thing and the reason why I started this podcast is, and I talked about it in the first episode where I told people, I said, you know, I was so energized every time I got to talk to somebody who was using Final Cut 10 and understood it, kind of grokked it and understood it and, you know, got it, that I was like, you know, I think other people would like these conversations. And it's been, for me, you know, this is 6 months now of doing this. This has been, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it. I've met some great people, and you realize that pretty much, you know, 85 to 90% of what most people hear about Final Cut 10 or think they know about Final Cut 10, it's pretty wrong, you know? And I think Apple has a huge, you know, it's a huge uphill battle, but luckily they're in a position where it's not a life or death thing for them.
Right.
You know, and so they're like, yeah, you know what? We're just going to keep plodding along. And, you know, when you look at the upgrade history, you go, wow, holy crap. I mean, in the last 3 years, it's barely recognizable from the first thing that they released in the summer of 2011. It's come so far. And, you know, 2 years ago, I made the decision that, you know, this is the better tool for me. And it's been energizing to talk to so many other people that agree.
It is frustrating that the waters are getting so adversarial about it, because one of the things I loved about the original Final Cut Pro 7 was it really ushered in an age where I just tote my drive over to your suite and now yeah. we're working.
Yeah.
And now I bring it over here and we're working. It was none of this, it's inside our domain and it's not coming out again.
That's a really good point. I never thought about that. You're right.
It's not like, oh, you want to change platforms for your mix? You want to change platforms for your color? Well, we're going to hit you up with a week's worth of conforming charges.
Yeah.
It really opened the possibility to share stuff really fast and quickly. And here's the best thing about Final Cut Pro X. It's $300. There's almost no excuse not to have it just to check it out for yourself.
Right.
It's like learning another language, except it's cheap and it's right there. And if you don't like it, you don't have to use it for anything. But if you do pick it up, it's certainly going to influence and deepen your appreciation of the other tools you use as well.
Do you remember what you said to me last week at Cutters?
Yeah, I did.
You were talking about knowing one system versus two or something. What was that?
I think that I was pretty charged up. I think that basically I said that I was so tired of people comparing, you know, who are the stupidest editors? The ones that use Final Cut X, Final Cut 7, Premiere, or Avid? Who are the stupidest editors?
Right.
Because that's sort of the tone that I see on all the forums. Oh, these people are stupid. These people are unprofessional.
Right, right, right.
And my answer is the stupidest editors I have ever met. And hands down, I'll say, you know, some of them were stupid. Some of them were truly stupid. Are the ones who only ever learned one system. And it's not that they were stupid people, but they limited themselves because they were scared or complacent or bought into somebody else's hype.
Yeah. Yeah, and now I'm gonna pick apart what you said there just a little bit, just so I feel a little bit better about myself. You said this, who only ever learned one system. Okay, good. Because yeah. I have said on this show many times that that I have, in my own mind, I am much better at my craft when I focus. And I have so much respect for guys like you or like Scott Simmons in Nashville or whatever, or so many people that are like, oh, it's an Avid job. Okay, fine. I'll cut that. Oh, it's a Final Cut job. Fine. I'll cut that. Oh, it's, you know, Premiere. Fine. You know, and I cannot do that. I cannot do that. So I would totally fall into your stupid category.
But you've edited on more than one system.
Well, yes, and that's what I'm getting at is that you said have only ever edited on one system. So yeah. So I have history of dealing with old Final Cut, Avid, Premiere. So okay, so I feel much better. All right, we can wrap this up now.
I'm going to get so much crap for saying that.
No. You know what? I think I wouldn't even worry about it. I'm not even certain anybody listens to this show, to be honest with you. I think you make a really good point. You know, and it's silly that we have turned these discussions into something that feels like a religion. It's not. It's a tool. There are good tools and there are bad tools. And there are, you know, a hammer is an awesome tool. It's an awesome tool until you have to put a screw in, you know? And I think that there's a lot of people, and I will admit there are times when I get this way where I'm like, use the hammer. It's awesome. Hammers are great. And sometimes people have to look at me and go, you know, it's a Phillips. It's a Phillips head screw. Can I just use the screwdriver? You know, it's like, okay. But I know that, and I've said this, I'm better when I concentrate, and I am better at my craft when I narrow my focus. But you're totally right. You know,
oh, jumping back and forth can be exhausting.
Oh, totally.
For sure.
Yeah. And I have so much respect for the people that can do it well.
You asked me another question when we met. I just wanted to touch on it because I thought it actually meshed with the points we were making there.
Okay.
I think that anybody who edits is an editor. I don't limit people. I think that some people are maybe more technically fearful or whatever else. But if you put two images together, and there are kids doing that all over the world, you know,
Right. You're
kind of getting a hit of the joy that I love about editing. And I feel that it should be a very inclusive term. I do have thresholds where I think that you get better as an editor. And it's almost like it's like learning a language. If you only ever speak to yourself, it's fairly easy, and you can get pretty good at doing stuff. If you have to work with somebody else and speak another language, you know, a second language to communicate between them, then you're closer to you may be an advocate. But if you want to be an interpreter, you have to learn many languages.
Right.
You know. And the benefit of learning many systems is that it's not just a monodimensional fluency. It really allows you to do the job that you do and know that you know how to do it, as opposed to feeling like you're just doing the tricks that you know.
Yeah, I'm the meltdown king. Watch me do a meltdown.
Right.
You know. I'm the sizzle reel king. Watch me do another one. I'm the happy faces guy. Watch me do another one. Yeah, no, I think I totally agree. And there is a joy that you see when you cut those two images together and you realize that, wow, I just changed the entire feel of this thing. And it is fun. I think the difference between, you know, you say anybody who edits is an editor, but when you find a really experienced person, they're gonna take you on a journey from the raw footage to the finished product a lot quicker if you let.
Oh yeah, there are more efficient editors. There are editors that are faster. There are editors that it's all experience, of course,
right?
But just doing editing is something that everybody should feel that they can do, and nobody should rip them down for. I certainly didn't mean that people who only ever use one application aren't editors or aren't professional. I just think that it's in the long run, it's more limiting, and it's not hard to.
You didn't say they weren't professional. You just said they were stupid.
I did.
You know, I think it's interesting that you drew the distinction between being efficient and fast. Because I know – I have a funny story, and I know this episode's going long. Sorry. I had a thing in early 1998. I bought an Avid, whatever was cool then, and I hated it, and I sold it. And then I bought a Media 100, and I'd only had it for like 2 weeks. And I did a job on a cruise ship, and I packed it all up with my RAID and, you know, tons of boxes of gear, and I had to move onto this cruise ship for a week. And the director I was working with, he was like, he was watching me cut. He's like, "Wow, you're really fast on this thing." I go, "Really?" And he goes, "Oh yeah." And he made a reference to another guy in San Francisco who will remain nameless, who owned a Media 100, big Media 100 advocate back in those days. And he goes, "Oh yeah, you're a lot faster than him." I'm like, "Really? He's used this thing for a couple of years now." And he goes, "Oh yeah, you're way faster." And then I told him, I go, "But just so you know, I'm not really fast. I'm just clicking on a lot of stuff really quick." because there was like some fundamental stuff I didn't know how to do. Like I didn't know how to ripple and paste. But what I did know how to do is command minus, 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 zoom way out, lasso a bunch of stuff, pick it up, drag it down, make some space, command plus, 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 paste in the shot, command minus, 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 grab all the stuff, drag it over, butt it up against it, command plus, 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 you know, and I was clicking like a madman, but I sure wasn't efficient. Big difference between fast and efficient.
It's a billable difference.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, hey, Jesse, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. And, you know, you are not the first – so, you know, you are not the first non-Final Cut user who's been on this show.
I say I don't use it regularly, and I appreciate it. But, yeah, I have used it.
I know. But I think if you listen to some episodes, you'll realize that – the vast majority of people are, you know, hardcore advocates, love it.
Oh,
you know?
I'm sure they are. Yeah. Okay.
And as is the case, I mean, it is kind of an Apple thing. You find people that just like, you know, they I don't even know how I want to say this, but, you know, sometimes you get it and it's hard to not be a bit of a fanatic about it, you know? And I think that some of the outside people look at that and they go, ugh, just more Apple people. I can't, I gotta go. I don't want to be a part of this. I need to leave. You know, but anyway, thanks so much for doing it. Now, if people are interested in finding out about Jesse Spencer, how do they find you online? Do you have like a web page, portal, something, maybe a Apple eWorld account name?
I do not.
Really? You don't have a web page?
I feel ill prepared for this.
Oh, that's fine. I'll tell you what, if you want to find Jesse Spencer in San Francisco, contact me. I'll hook you up with
there we go.
Not a problem at all. All right, Jesse, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
What did I tell you? I told you would like Jesse. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Just a great guy and a lot of laughs in that interview and wonderful insight on the industry as a whole. So this episode is already way too long. I'm not gonna do much more here. If you know somebody who needs to be on the show, or somebody you'd like to talk to, or somebody you think that whose input would be appreciated, by all means, contact me, let me know. And I will also say, best way to contact me is through Twitter. And it seems to me there's been a couple of recommendations that I may have let slip. So if you recommended somebody and you haven't heard from them, send me another tweet, please. Also, please use the audio tab on the Digital Cinema Cafe website. And don't be confused. Digital Cinema Cafe is the hosting site for both shows. Use that little audio tab. Send me questions. So questions or comments or whatever. If you just want to just sick of me and want to tell me not to do long shows ever again. So that's it for this episode of The Grill. We will see you again. Let me think. This is the Friday episode. So you'll be hearing from us again on Monday morning. Later.